Doreen Howard. I'm at the
Jobs Bank.
The Jobs Bank out in DeWitt. We will be interviewing Don Davis today. It is December 20th, 2005, approximately 8 o'clock a.m.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fidua.
Yeah, I just put the stop and then let it go.
It's recording.
Oh, it's recording. Okay.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fidua.
Okay. And Don, can you state and spell your last name and your address?
Yes, it's Don Davis, D-A-V-I-S. My address is 16720 Wacoosta Road, Grand Ledge, Michigan.
Okay. Don, are you married and do you have any children?
I am. I have three children.
Okay. And what is your educational background or military? Do you have any military service?
I do. I have 3 years military. I served in Vietnam. I was a pilot. I was in a lot of different areas in the military. And my education is criminal justice. I have a criminal justice degree and also an electrical degree.
What is your seniority date, and can you talk about the first time that you hired in to General Motors?
My original seniority date was the year I got out of service, which is 1962. I hired in Flint Chevrolet, and but I worked 3 years, and then I quit and broke my seniority to go to college and do some other adventures. So I have a total of 30 years, but again, it's broken service, so I don't know what date we really want to use.
Now, your service time at Flint, was that all at the Chevy plant, or did you go to other facilities in Flint?
I worked at other plants in Flint. I worked at Chevrolet, what they call down in the hole, which is Chevrolet Assembly. I worked at Flint Truck Plant. I worked at AC Spark Plug. I worked at Flint Fisher. I worked at several plants around the Flint area because of layoffs and reductions in forces and things like that.
Now, during that time, you hired in as an hourly employee, correct?
I did. The early years in the 60s, I hired in as a production worker. And besides, I thought I wanted to go out and try some other things, so that's when I went back to school to become an electrician and eventually coming back into Chevrolet as an electrician. And then, again, transferring over to Lansing after that.
And at what time frame did you come to the Lansing facility?
I came from Chevrolet in 1982. There was a layoff, and I was transferred over as an area hire in 1982 and hired in the body shop as an electrician.
And at what time frame did you go on to management?
I went on management in 1985 and became a skilled trade supervisor again in the body shop for a period of time. I went to trim for a while, and I had the trim and building 23, which was body shipping.
Now, when you came in 82, the plant was called Fisher Body at that date?
That's correct.
Okay. Marilyn?
When you came from to Lansing from Flint, were there any big differences that you saw in as far as the cultures of the people that worked, and how were you accepted as being an electrician from another plant?
There was a total difference in culture, and the environment was totally different over here from what I was used to in Flint. The atmosphere, that it was more friendly over here. We were accepted easily into the plant. There was absolutely no problems. The management union relationship was so much better over here. I mean, I could tell you stories about Flint that we don't want to talk about. Not that they were that bad, but they were so much different. You never saw hourly and salary mingle in Flint, ever. Whether it be a restaurant, and after hours, you know, to have a drink after work, whatever. You just never saw that. And that was probably the biggest thing that I saw, the biggest difference I saw when I came over here.
So when you came in, you hired in to the Fisher Body Plant as an hourly employee, and you said you were an electrician at that time. Describe what it was like when you first came in there. What was the facilities like? You know, what was the atmosphere in there?
Well, it was an older plant, but I was used to that because most of the plants in Flint were older plants. But all the, in fact, all the equipment when I first got here was the old style, the old equipment. And then I got to help set up the new robotic areas and all the things that we did in Lansing back in the mid-80s, and got to do that whole transition thing.
So the robotics, that all came in with the Grand Am?
That's correct.
In, what, 84? Is that when that?
84 is when we started, right.
Can you explain some of the differences between the way that the facilities was prior to the robotics and a lot of the technology coming into the plant? What was some of the differences that you saw?
Well, the biggest thing was that it was the old hands-on weld guns, everything to do in the body shop, which is what I was most familiar with. Were all the standalone fixtures, no robotics, everything was done by hand. And the biggest transition there, of course, was we had a lot of ramps to come up. We had to learn how to run the equipment, we installed the equipment, and then there was a big difference in the way the people operated with the new machinery, because it didn't really eliminate jobs, but it changed jobs. It moved people to different things, and some of the things that people did by hand and the robots did. But in my way of thinking, I didn't see that it did replace people like they thought it might.
Marilyn?
Did you find that actually the robots took away, took the jobs that were like probably unsafe and unhealthy for people to be doing?
To a lot of degree, that's true. There was a lot of jobs that people did with hands-on that probably weren't safe by today's standards especially. And both for ergonomics and everything else, that did relieve a lot of those stresses, for sure.
So when you were doing those jobs as an electrician at that time, were you working many hours?
We worked on the average, I worked 7 days a week all my life, pretty much in GM, up until the last couple of years. That's just the way it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, there was... You work 7 days a week. You work sometimes double shifts, and that was just a way of life when you were in skilled trades.
So because that's a way of life and it becomes such a big part of your life, what were some of the things that you did? I mean, did your workers become like your work family? And what types of things did you do to pass the time insofar as how did you get along, communicate, and pass the time?
Well, if you look at the clock, you were with the people you work with more than you were your own family. Your awake hours, you spent more time at work, which we all do anyway, with your workers than you do at home. So there's a lot of, the downside of that is that you don't see your family as much, you don't see your children grow up as you should. We did spend an awful lot of hours in the factory, and it did not allow us to do a lot of the family things that we should have probably been doing.
So your coworkers became your work family? Were the things, did you guys have dinners?
We did. It was a close family. I mean, especially by area. If you worked in the body shop or if you worked in trim or paint, you had dinners. There was always somebody bringing in food or cooking. It was very close. And even after hours, you found that you would even socialize after hours with the same people you worked with. So, yeah, it was a close family.
I was going to digress just a little bit. What brought you into Fisher? Well, what brought you to the GM Fisher Body family?
Well, I worked outside for a number of years. I was an electrician. I was a pilot. I was a policeman, and I did a lot of things I guess the final result that brought me back in the factory was I enjoyed being an electrician. I enjoyed the work. I was getting a little older, more mature, I'd like to say, but actually older. And so I thought I wanted to go someplace to retire from. And the jobs that I was doing back in those, in the 70s, didn't pay as well on the outside. And I'll be honest, I was looking for security probably more than anything.
So what made you decide to go from hourly to salary?
Well, I don't know. I was approached several times to go on salary, and I really didn't want to. I was a union person all my life, and I firmly believed in the union. I still believe in the union more than I probably do the salary side, and for a lot of reasons. And then, of course, I was apprehensive. I didn't really want. I didn't know that the other side of the fence, if you would. I didn't want to manage people so much. But then I thought maybe I could help a little bit more with the, maybe change some of the styles and things like that if I did go on management. So that's why I did it.
That's okay. I'm going to move back a little bit further because you said that you were union active. And were you active in the union prior to becoming a salaried person?
I was not ever an elected official in the union, but I was all my life, or all the years up until the time I came back in the factory, I was, you know, I served my time on the picket line with everybody else. I went through labor, strifes, especially in the Flint area. That was a pretty volatile area. There was always something, you know, no matter where you worked, you had problems, you know, with the labor management arena. So it was just... I just believe in the union. If the union hadn't been there, the salary folks or nobody else would have had what they had. So that's my background.
That's good. All right. You said so that you could change the salary style. To you, what made a bad supervisor or a good supervisor, and what were the changes that you wanted to have?
Well, a good supervisor finds who his people are, finds out what their strengths and weaknesses are, and lets them perform their job without telling them every step of the way that everything they have to do. They know their jobs, no matter what their jobs are, skilled, non-skilled, whatever. They know how to do their job, and you just put the faith back in them and let them do their work. If they need help, then you assist them. But you don't, I don't know, that's just the way I was.
That's great. Doreen Howard, I want to take you back to something that you touched on. You talked about strikes and things like that in Flint. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the issues that surrounded that?
Well, there was both, you know, there was wildcat strikes that I was involved in again, Flint was a lot different than Lansing. That's one of the big differences that Marilyn asked me about. There was times that it wasn't even safe to go to work because if there was a wildcat or whatever, you better participate. And there was people that really, really wanted to go to work, and they would the company would put people out on disciplinary. They would send them out by the numbers, like 50 or 100 people, and they would replace them with people right off the street and try to break the jobs. So there was a lot of strife. I mean, there was you'd have management people up on the roofs of the building taking your picture, going out to your car. I mean, it was just a totally different atmosphere over there. So it was just a way of life, just a totally different culture.
Can you explain what a wildcat strike is?
Well, wildcat is pretty much based on the fact that it's not sanctioned either by the union or the company. People would just up and walk out over an issue. It could be a safety issue. It could be added work that was put on some operators, and the whole plant could walk out, and that's what they would do. It didn't happen often, but it wasn't very, very friendly when it did.
Doreen Howard, when you came to Fisher Body, you said you never saw the conflicts that you saw between the union and the management at the Flint facility. Was there ever any point during your time frame here that they had any any type of strike at her at the Fisher facility? And if there was, do you recall what it was about?
You know, we did have the one strike, and it only lasted, what, about 3 days? But I was out of town at the time. I wasn't even involved in that. So I be honest with you, I don't remember what those issues were that brought that about. But as far as the relationship between the two, no. Everything was always negotiable. Everybody sat down and talked about it. They didn't always agree, but they always seemed to resolve things in a much friendlier and in a more professional way.
Fisher Body, over the years, had become known as the capital of quality. What do you think about that statement, and what do you feel makes that statement true? And compare the quality at the Fisher plant compared to the quality that you saw at the Flint plants.
Well, the capital of quality was a good statement, because we did, from the time I got here, they did, quality was number one, not numbers. And in Flint, if you had a job that you had to produce so many parts, if you could produce those parts in 3 hours and your shift was 8 hours, you went home in 3 hours and you got paid for eight. So there was never any quality built into a system like that. Totally the opposite here in Lansing, because everybody, you had different checks and balances. It was a personal thing. All employees felt responsible for the quality of the product that they built, which we never saw in some of the other plants.
I had a question for you, Marilyn Coulter. As a hourly employee and as a salaried employer, can you tell us what were one of your most memorable moments or one of your most rewarding moments?
I don't know. That would be so difficult to answer. I would tell you that I probably enjoyed being an hourly worker more than a salary worker, and primarily because I like to do hands-on. I mean, I just don't like to stand back and supervise, and it was really difficult for me to do that. I mean, because I really, again, I thought I was pretty good at what I did, but then I couldn't do it anymore. And I had to try to, you know, help people do their job, but not being able to do anything myself, it was just different. But the satisfactions of keeping equipment running, the satisfactions of having a good workforce and things like that, I guess that's probably the most memorable part of what I did.
Are you the only member of your family that works in Fisher Body or for JM?
I am. My father worked in Fisher Body back in Flint in the 40s, but just for a short time. But I was the only career person, if you would, in my family for GM.
Great. Doreen Howard. How did the changing in the, as far as the plant population based on gender and race, how did that affect you as far as the comparison between the Flint, what was the demographics of the workforce there versus when you came into the Fisher plant, what was the demographics like in our plant?
I would say in that respect they were comparable. I don't think there was a lot of difference in how many women or how many minorities or how many, you know, what the workforce was made up with. Flint was a pretty diverse town as far as that goes. So I didn't see a lot of difference there. I really didn't.
Being that you worked in the skilled trades arena, Marilyn Coulter, and you were an hourly person and a salary person in the skilled trades arena, for females, what would you say the skilled trades world is like for them? And has it changed over the years?
It's changed greatly. When females were first accepted in the skilled trades, they had a really rough road. It was a male-dominated workforce, and the women were really discriminated against. They had a tough time. The early women that came on, they had to prove themselves as a man, if you would. I mean, they had come into a man's world, if you would. And they did have a tough time. And fortunately, some of the first ones that came on that I saw came on could handle themselves as a man. But that really wasn't fair. They shouldn't have had to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's changed drastically. I mean, you just don't. It's anymore, it's who can do the job, male, female, doesn't matter. That's changed a lot.
What,
Doreen Howard, I guess, do you feel that the supervisory techniques have changed since you first went into the salary arena versus how it is today?
Yes, it's changed a lot. When whether it was Flynn or Fisher Body, the earlier years was totally dominated by the supervisor. Supervisor told you everything, what to do it, when to do it, how to do it, and didn't involve the employees, didn't let them use their minds, if you would, to help with the process. That's changed, completely changed. As a matter of fact, it's gone the other way. So much to the point where I don't think that the supervisor really does a lot of supervising. It's the hourly folks that put their teams together, decide how the job should be done, the best way it can be done, the quality aspects of it, the environmental, all kinds of things that they do now. But it's a totally different environment.
Marilyn Coulter.
John, when we talk about supervisory techniques, you came up through the rank and file and onto salary. How do you feel works having a manager who comes in through the rank and file versus one who comes in off the street? Is there a big difference?
Well, there's. I think there is. I think that helps the person. I think that, you know, if they've come off the floor, came from that environment, learned the jobs, knew the jobs, then became a supervisor, I think you have to know the job to be able to teach the job or to supervise that job. Nothing against college degreed folks that come in that have no prior experience. They come in with a different attitude, different aspect. They're educated, but they don't always know how to deal with the people. They don't understand all the jobs. And if they're smart enough, they can learn to do that, if they can put their trust in the people and learn from the people. But I think that guy or woman that comes off the floor has the upper hand, I think. I think they do a better job.
Insofar, because being skilled trades, that's can be a very dangerous job. Both as a hourly person and a salaried person, can you stress anything that's important insofar that you have to do as a manager to make sure your employees are safe?
Well, we're mandated by my OSHA and different laws as to what our safety training protocol is. And as a manager, it's become more apparent in the last few years is that you have to make sure that everybody's fully safety trained. They have all the equipment, the safety equipment, the training, because there's liabilities now, too, in the last few years. If a supervisor allows an employee to work in an unsafe manner and that person gets injured, there's liability back on that supervisor today. It's not just the company that'll take that responsibility. That individual is responsible for their employees. So there's a lot at stake. I mean, primarily, number one is you want to make sure nobody gets hurt. You want everybody to go home just like they came to work. So, but it's inherent. You have to make sure that everybody's safety trained.
Doreen Howard, you touched base on some of the safety training. As a skilled trades employee, what type of training did they have? Was there training that you had to have prior to going on your certain jobs? Was there training once you became an electrician that you had to continue your education? Was there any type of ongoing training that you had to take?
Yeah, there's classes both from fall hazard. You had those types of classes. You had electrical safe work practice. You had equipment that you wore, and that's changed over the years. It was quite lax early on. Now it's the rubber gloves and sleeves and all the things that you have to do that have come into the workforce. it seems sometimes we go overboard. At one point in time, we did hardly enough to ensure the safety, and then we go the other way to the other extreme. And it makes it a little more difficult for the employees to do their work. But bottom line is, it's all about safety, and so you have to look at it that way.
Do you think that you actually, is there any statistics that they've proven that all this training and additional precautions have helped over the years? Or
they have. They have. You know, I couldn't recite any, but I would tell you that my early years, I saw a lot of people get hurt very badly. I've seen people get killed. I've witnessed that. And I would say that the last 15 years or so in this environment, I've not seen anybody severely injured in any way. Now, lacerations and maybe a broken bone or something like that, but nothing to the degree that I saw early on.
Marilyn Coulter, and I know it does affect you, but I too have witnessed someone, you know, who got killed in the plant. Was that in Lansing Fisher Body that you witnessed that?
That's one. I did see one killed here. That's correct. A contractor, outside contractor. Maybe that's what you're referring to.
Was that the one in 3X?
Yes.
Yep,
that's
the
one.
Same one.
Yeah.
How, when being a manager and a skilled trades person, how did it affect you, and how did you deal with that?
Well, the sad part about any accident is if after you analyze it and you realize what happened, it should never happen. And most accidents are that way. We can all look back and sometimes joke about it, as long as we don't get hurt. But when you have a person or people that are not familiar with equipment or the plan or the environment they're in, the sad thing about that particular one was that that person got in the line that didn't know the line was going to start up, went in at break time or lunchtime, as I remember. And the line started up, and he was subsequently killed. But, you know, it affects you. I mean, I've had, you know, you've got to remember that we're with these folks more than we are our own families at home. So if somebody, you know, gets hurt like that. But the other side of it is you got to learn from that and pass that on, and that's what we do.
I know that General Motors does have they've been very good as far as having provisions for their workers. I know they had work family reps that were there to help the people who were on the line. Were there people that also helped your employees also?
Yes. Yeah, there was. There was counseling. There was a lot of things available to the folks. And it's unfortunate that everybody had to witness that. But the other side of it is that the Fisher Body folks really came together on that. And even though that was an outside person that was killed, they took up a collection for the family. They did all kinds of things. It was really rewarding. I mean, that was really a nice gesture. But it was a tragic thing to see.
Doreen Howard, that sounded as if that was probably one of your saddest times here. Do you recall any happy or funny moments that occurred during your time at the plant?
Oh boy, in 30 years you see a lot of things that are funny, but
so what's some of the pranks or some of the crazy things that people used to do to entertain themselves?
Well, you know, Fisher Body always, well, all the plants back in the early years had a good, had more fun at their jobs, if you would. There was always pranks going on. They claim there, even sometimes it was a little socializing that maybe shouldn't have went on. But I know down in the body shop, they used to put gas in the A pillars and B pillars and things. And so the next guy come along a weld and they'd have a little explosion in there and scare people. And of course, there was people rolling cars that weren't appropriately dressed, things like that. There was a lot of things. I probably ought not go into some of those.
No, that's one of the things that we're interested in, the culture and things like that. What did you do during lunch times and things like that? Did you eat in the supervisor dining area? Or did you?
I never did.
Do?
I never did. That was another interesting thing about Lansing, was a lot of the folks went across, and I'll use Harry's as an example. We couldn't wait till lunchtime to go over and have a beer, and it didn't matter if you were hourly or salary over there. That's what really struck me. The first time I went into Harry's and saw a supervisor sitting at a table with some hourly folks, I was amazed. You didn't see that. I mean, you didn't see that. That salary folks didn't even walk through a parking lot over in Flint. So I thought, you know, God, who is this guy? Well, the one guy that I saw that I met in the bar one day was actually turned out to be my supervisor. So it was interesting. But no, I seldom ate in the plant. That was a chance to get out of there, and I did.
So I know you said that they took a benefit dinner. Did you participate in many of the benefit dinners that they did in the plant? Did they do a lot of that?
Oh, yes. They had benefits for a lot of folks over the years. Every one they ever had, I participated in. Whether it would be at Christmas time for the Toys for Tots, or whether it was an employee that had cancer or whatever. Fisher was really good about that. I didn't see that as much in other plants, but Fisher was great about that. If there was an employee sick, no matter where, what department that person was in, all the areas put on a fundraiser for that family, and they did a wonderful job at it and raised a lot of money. And there was a lot of hard work that went into to make that happen.
I know we did a lot for people inside and outside the plant, and that's one of the things that working 7 days, did you notice a lot of the people who were at the gates when we left from the outside communities that came to collect for collections and stuff?
They did, yeah. There was, no matter what the occasion was, that you're right. They were either in the plant or at the gates, and everybody did very, very well with that. They all gave money or donated food, whatever. And Fisher was a big family. They just seemed to, you know, they didn't all know each other, but they seemed to get along very well.
So you worked 7 days a week. What did you do for holidays?
Worked.
And did you have dinners and things then also?
We did. It's just, you know, that tradition always went on. But that's true. I can remember working 6 months straight without a day off. I mean, we used to kind of joke about it, you know, how many days you work without ever having a day off, because you didn't know any different. You just got up and you went to work. It didn't matter if it was Sunday or Christmas or what it was. You just got up and went to work, because that's just the way it was.
What shifts did you work, Don?
I worked all shifts. I spent, as most people did, my early years on second and third shift. And then the later years, I spent probably the last 5 or 7 years or so on days because of what my job was. But it took a while for seniority-wise to get to the day shift, obviously.
And that's your preferred shift?
It was. In some ways, the night shifts worked better. I enjoyed working nights, selfishly, I guess, as I look back. But it was a good time to be in the plant, maybe more than it was on day shift.
Doreen Howard, as a skilled tradesperson, did you ever do what they consider a governmental job for anyone, or did you ever have anyone make something for you in the plant? And if so,
that sounds like
what kind of things did they make, and what kind of
that sounds like a loaded question, but yeah, of course that happened. There was what you call government work was something that somebody wanted made, either for their person or for their department. It wasn't always something that you made to give away or to take out of the plant, but there was things, creature comforts, as I would call them. Some of the production workers would want a locker made or a bench made or this or that made. So, yeah, from a skilled trades standpoint, we had the ability to do that. So we did that a lot. The early years, I would tell you that there was a lot more of that went on. There was cars painted. There was things that they did that was sanctioned, actually. But as the years went on, that changed a lot.
Speaking of the outside and being an electrician, did that allow you to, even though working 7 days would be difficult, to do things on the outside with your profession also?
Well, on the outside, you worked. It was a different environment. You worked out of a hall, and you were sent to different cities or locations. Sometimes it wasn't. It was actually worse because you traveled. What they call a tramp. You'd go where they told you to go. So the work didn't necessarily stay in your hometown or in your close to your house. So the shop was the factory was probably a lot better in that respect. Even though you worked more or longer hours, you always went to the same place within you were closer to home.
Now, did you ever have to do things for family members or friends with your skill?
Oh, yeah. You mean as far as being an electrician? Mm-hmm. Of course. I mean, if somebody's hot water quit or they lost power in their house, that's who they call, somebody they know that can help fix that, and I would do that.
Don, does your skills flow over into any hobbies that you may have?
Well, I was always a mechanical person, whether it be an electrician or a mechanical person, whatever. I like to build cars. I've flown airplanes for a lot of years. I fish and hunt, I guess, like most. But I guess probably my biggest hobby is building cars on the outside, street rods, if you would. And I also do a little racing, things like that.
I know you have quite an extensive collection of vehicles, and you had some older vehicles that you were restoring.
Can you
talk a little bit about that hobby?
Oh, golly, I've had a lot of cars over the years. Right now I've got a 31 Ford Model A. I've got a 70 Chevrolet Nova. I've got a 50 Chevrolet pickup. And I've probably got a collection of another 30 cars or so tucked away in barns that I'm going to hopefully restore when I retire.
So,
30 cars.
Yes.
So the amount of time invested in the plant was very good to you as far as being able to purchase those extra hobby investments there.
Yeah, there's some truth to that. I mean, first, you got to remember, General Motors, we were paid very well. And again, I guess we spend what we make sometimes. But I wasn't that, I didn't waste or spend that much money on my cars. I've accrued these over the years. So everybody knows I do that. So if they see a dealer, they see a car for sale, they'll always come and say, "Hey, Don, I saw this car. Were you interested?" Well, I kind of wish they wouldn't do that because a lot of times I would just go buy it. But, usually they're pretty good deals. My wife didn't always think so, but I did.
Touching base on some of the benefits that General Motors has offered to you over the years, what's one of the most appreciated benefits that you think we've received?
Well, I've always thought that General Motors treated me very well. Now, did I always agree with everything that happened? No. I didn't agree always with the philosophy of the management and things like that. But bottom line was they were trying to provide a job for us, and I appreciated that. I worked hard for them, and I think in the same token, they took care of us. I'm nervous about our future. I don't particularly care to see the way the future looks for all of us, especially at my point of life where I'm within months or weeks maybe of retiring. I'm concerned, very concerned about it. But I thought that General Motors was a good place to work.
Were you ever able to take advantage of the tuition assistance program when you were younger? You said that you had worked for General Motors and then left to go to school. Was that through tuition assistance, or did you just quit and then rehire back in?
I did not use. I used some for some personal classes through General Motors, but most of my college degree and all my other outside work I did with my GI benefits, my military benefits. Which worked fine because I was not employed by General Motors when I did go to college, so my GI Bill took care of that, or took care of a lot of it.
And is there any difference in that you've noticed between the hourly benefits and the salary benefits? Is there anything one way or the other that you see a difference in as far as benefits?
Well, yes, but by the same token, I mean, it's hard to look. It's, you got to look at it in the right way. Salary folks are paid some more monies. By the same token, they contribute more money back for some of their benefits, and that's the way it's always been. It seems to be a little more on the salary side as far as their co-pays, things like that, because it's you know, there's no contract with salary folks. They can do that, and again, General Motors is in serious trouble, and I think so. You know, and they went to the union and renegotiated certain things, and union has give, I will say, give back some things too. But for the most part, salary is pretty top heavy when it comes to some of that.
Over the years that you've been there, have I know that during the holidays they would have like salaried Christmas parties off-site and in different venues like that. Can you talk about any of the types of things like, I guess, you
activities
know,
that they
yeah, did. Dinners or any off-site activities that they did, some of the things that you got to go to?
I would say that back in the 80s, the salary workforce was probably a tighter workforce. They were more like the hourly folks. They had, everybody knew each other. They knew their families. They knew their children. But as the years went on, it seemed to, that changed. And I guess I don't know why, but it's been a lot of years since the salary side of General Motors has ever done any outside functions such as Christmas parties, things like that. They just don't do it.
Don, do you attribute any of that from once again having managers that are coming from the outside versus from coming up through the rank and file and being having longevity together?
Yeah. You know, it used to be that if you hired or your parents hired in a GM, they retired from GM. You spent Everybody worked at GM, they were there for 30 years. Now you see, especially in the management arena, you see a lot of younger folks coming in, and their careers sometimes are very short. They don't stay. They either get promoted out or they opt to go to another company. There's not the closeness that there was in that side of the house.
Doreen Howard. In recent years, there's been a lot of contract and supervision that has come in. How has that affected the workplace environment?
Well, again, you know, you look at the way GM has done business. A lot of the salary side, they wanted to reduce salary headcount because of the expense. So it was cheaper, less money to contract those people in. And some of them were pretty good supervisors. But there was no allegiance, if you would, to the company because they never worked for GM. They worked for the contract house. They had a different outlook on the way they did their jobs. They could pay people, they could make things happen, but there was no allegiance, and that's kind of too bad.
How do you think that affected the outcome that the hourly people saw and the outcomes of the quality, et cetera, of the vehicle itself with the contract supervision coming in?
Well, I don't want to say anything really bad about the contracts, but there's really no ownership by a lot of them. They were here to do a job. They were paid quite a bit less money. They didn't enjoy the benefits, and they knew that they, at a moment's notice, they could be terminated. So they didn't have the ownership, if you would, and I'm sure that filtered on to the folks that worked under them. You know, you respect the person you work for by what they know and how they treat you and what they can teach you, and if they're just here to pay you and go home, then you don't have that interaction.
I guess one last question that I wanted to know is, let's end on a happy note. What's one of the fun things that you can remember doing or in the plant? What's something happy or fun that you can remember?
You know, there's so many things over the years. I would tell you that I didn't have any bad times at General Motors. I managed, for the most part, very good people. They did a good job. They were dedicated to GM. We had our parties. We had our social times out of the plant. I've enjoyed working at General Motors. I'm going to miss it. Marilyn said earlier about the people, and I guess I'm going to miss that more than anything. But you get a bond with the people you work with. And again, you're with them more than you are your family members, so you've got to get along. But I've just totally enjoyed working with General Motors.
One last question for me, Marilyn. You said that you had a lot of vehicles, so you were always around a lot of cars. And I know that General Motors here in Lansing, they've had a lot of different opportunities to display our vintage cars or to display cars. Did you ever participate in any of those promotional type things when we showed our vehicles to the public?
I did. Yeah, I went to, I worked at the Detroit show. I've worked at some of the shows like that. And yes.
What's that like to go out and talk about what you do to the public?
Well, you're proud of your product. I hate to say the downside of that is that we only have one car anymore. You know, we've lost Chevrolet, Pontiac, Buick. I mean, our parents grew up with a certain car. You drove a certain car. Those days are gone. There's no product allegiance anymore. It's the same engine goes in every car. It's just typically the same body style. I think our engineering could be better. But the earlier years, you know, you picked a particular car, Oldsmobile. That's what Lansing was famous for. I very much liked Oldsmobile, so I was proud to represent that and pass that on to the public. I enjoyed that.
So what about your own personal babies? Did you ever get to display any of those?
I do. I go to car shows all over the country. I go to, I'm pretty much a Chevrolet guy, so I have a lot of different styles of Chevrolets, and so I go to car shows all over the United States, actually.
Is there one car that's maybe your number one baby?
Oh, that'd be hard to say. I always say that they're all that way, and I'm never going to sell a car, but that's not true either, because I do end up selling. My first car was a 50 Chevrolet, and I restored one, and I drove that for a lot of years, and somebody come along and wanted to buy it, and I sold it. So I guess I couldn't say that any one particular car was my favorite.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Was there anything that we didn't touch on that you'd like to be sure to share?
No, I enjoyed the interview. The only thing I would say that was probably the biggest difference here in Lansing, too, is that what General Motors is not used to with the body shipping aspect, and I'm sure you guys have talked about it in other interviews.
Actually, we really haven't touched a lot on that.
Talk a little bit about that.
If you wanted to elaborate on that a little bit more.
Well, General Motors, as you know, when the Fisher Body Division, such as in Even and Flint, bodies were built by Fisher, and then they were assembled at either Buick or chassis, in this case here in Lansing. And I managed that activity for about 7 years. And that was probably one of the most interesting jobs that I had, in the fact that there's an expensive operation. Those trucks, those seven trucks that we've had on the road day and night to haul our bodies, was really an extension of the line. No matter what the weather was, no matter what the moods of the drivers, you had to get the cars across town. And those seven drivers, if you want to think about it, really controlled all of Lansing. Because if anything happened to one of those drivers and didn't get the bodies across town, you shut all of Lansing down. So, and again, expense-wise, it was very expensive. It averaged about $3.5 million a year just to run those trucks. So it was very expensive. But that was, you had to keep the trucks up 100%. We had to, go by DOT regulations. We had to work with the local police agencies, the local governmental agencies, as far as keeping the roads safe and open for us. We had to get our traffic lights timed and things so we could get over there in a quick manner. And it was just an interesting thing.
Don, how many vehicles would be able to be placed on these trucks to be finished?
You had seven cars, seven bodies in each truck, in each trailer. And if you got to put the numbers together, we averaged, when we ran two shifts, 5 days a week, we built 1,000 cars a day. I'm sorry, we built 2,000 cars a day, 500 a line when we were on each line on each shift. So that was 2,000 cars a day. And if you think about putting them times 7 in a trailer and taking it across town, that was quite an undertaking.
So being the capital of quality and building one vehicle in two different plants, but dealing with the city and everything, that was a major undertaking.
It was. The drivers were very well-skilled drivers. Our equipment, we spared no money to keep the equipment up. We had the best of everything that we could buy to keep the trucks running, whether it be tires, whether it be engines, whatever. It's just almost like we treated it like an airplane almost. There was nothing that we wouldn't do to keep those trucks running safely.
Doreen Howard, was that process unique just to the Fisher Body facility, or was there other General Motors plants that did the body hauling?
I know that we were the last plant to do it in General Motors that will ever do it. I know that Flint did it up into the 70s, early 80s. And then we inherited their trucks. We took those over when they were still running gasoline trucks and went to diesel. But Lansing was the last General Motors plant to ever do it. There are still Ford, Chrysler, I'm not sure. I know there is a Ford plant that does that. In fact, they had to open up, make some bridges bigger to get some of their trucks down in the Detroit area crossed, which we never had to do. But General Motors will probably never do that again. That's why they built their new plants under one roof.
Mm-hmm. But it still makes it good. I guess it gives GM pride, though, to know that we were constantly getting awards and we were basically a dinosaur.
We were. We absolutely were. But again, I think a lot of that goes back to the people and their ideas and the way they did things. They believed in what they did, and they did a good job at it.
That's great. So I guess I'd like to let, for anyone that's going to be listening to this, that's going to be a manager, what would be the words that you'd say if they were coming into an assembly plant? What's the best thing that they could do?
As a manager, you mean as an hourly person coming into a plant?
Either one.
Well, I've always respected the people that I work for, and I think that they need to do the same. I think that they need to keep an open mind, and they need to want to do what they're doing and appreciate the fact that they've been given the best training and the best place to work and good wages, and I think they should do a good job for the plant.
Thank you.
Thank you.